diseases, says the president. The president of Iran said the country's successful handling of the situation after the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic can provide a roadmap to tackling contagious disease in future. Speaking at a meeting of the Coronavirus Fight National Headquarters, President Hassan Rouhani said Iran has taken very great and valuable measures to control the COVID-19 pandemic over the past year. The coronavirus statistics show that the overall situation in Iran, except in one or two provinces, is satisfactory, the president added, warning, though, that a fourth wave of the pandemic may erupt in case of laxity in carrying out the health regulations. A look at TRT World gives us an idea of the UN's mindset. UN says U.S. sanctions hampered Iran's COVID-19 response. UN Special Rapporteur on Iran calls for easing of U.S. sanctions on this country. U.S. sanctions have crippled Iran's healthcare sector, contributing to Iran's inadequate COVID-19 response, says the rapporteur. The government has faced significant difficulties in containing the virus, in part due to the weakening of the national healthcare system and the wider economy, the report citing the UN Special Rapporteur Javed Rehman's observations said, adding that the UN Secretary General has been sharing the same concerns. Rehman holds the U.S. responsible for adding strain to Iran's healthcare sector, which was already reeling from the effects of severe sanctions imposed by the U.S. in 2018. Tehran Times makes a mention of ITB Berlin. ITB Berlin, which bills itself as the world's leading travel trade show, has presented a taste of Iran. Due to the pandemic, ITB Berlin was held virtually from March 9th to 12th, featuring some 3,300 exhibitors from 120 countries. The presence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, particularly its private sector in this fair, shows the dynamism of the country's tourism industry after a year of closure. And we declare in this exhibition that we are ready to bring tourism back on track again after the epidemic is curbed, said Vali Taymouri, the deputy tourism chief. The number of foreign visitors to Iran plunged 94% in the first 9 months of the current Iranian calendar year, starting March the 20th, 2020, from a year earlier. Government data showed, as the coronavirus pandemic takes a heavy toll on the tourism industry. And that's it for today's News Segment. A joint scheme between Iran and Russia was scheduled for late March to mass-produce Sputnik V just before year-end in Iran. But with the Persian vaccine out and to be mass-administered by late April and early May, I asked what need there was for a Russian line, especially as the first batches of the Russian vaccine to be mass-administered will also be available in late April.
The fact that different institutions are working on vaccines is valuable because ultimately the practical benefits of such attempts will be recorded and reserved in the country. But we know that some teams are more likely to succeed than the others. That's why we predict that in this process of experimentation and development, a few can get to the production phase. Both timing and the volume of production are significant.
Doctors foresee a need for 120 million doses of the anti-corona COVID-19 vaccine to inoculate 60 million of Iran's 85 million strong population with two jabs each. But vaccine production and mass administration is a slow process everywhere, and this country is among the few to have even attempted the feat, and attempted it has, with success. And that is in spite of U.S. sanctions against this country.
The vaccine production has passed stage one. The next stage of production is the semi-industrial phase, which we hope will provide several hundred thousand doses a month, given the efforts that are being made. We expect that in the final stage, which according to our company's main goal is scheduled for June, we can produce 10 million doses.
The Iran and Russia vaccine production will take place in the facilities of an Iranian pharmaceutical company. The two countries will be producing between 36 and 40 million doses of Sputnik V in Iran within the next 12 months. They jointly decided Iran would host the operation, mainly to increase supplies of the jab to countries in the Middle East or West Asia.
As an epidemiologist, I believe that many of our neighboring countries aren't reporting valid data. We've always been witnessing cases being underreported for all kinds of diseases, and especially COVID-19. What I'm trying to say is that we are in much better shape concerning diagnosis and treatment compared to many other nations.
Having said quite a bit on the Iran-Russia project, I have to say a word on the Iran-Cuba vaccine, which was in the spotlight before anything else. Cuba, being a country sanctioned by the US like Iran, it joined forces with this country so that the two together, that's Iran's Pasteur Institute and Cuba's Finley Institute, produce a vaccine jointly. This is not to forget, Cuba's present Cuban vaccine is among the foreign vaccines Iran will be administering, having participated in its trial period. So far, with regard to ready vaccines, Iran has imported several consignments of vaccine from Russia, China, and India. As for Iran's singular projects, three homegrown vaccines have undergone clinical trials in this country. Over 10 Iranian centers and startups applied to produce a vaccine. The sum of all efforts and acceptance is that Iran is looking forward to 4 to 5 homegrown vaccines now.
In Iran, 12 or 13 different projects are being implemented on different platforms, which are production methods in research and development stage. Of course, because some companies undertake several projects simultaneously, the number of firms that are working on the vaccines is less than this number. Some of the companies, like the Barakat Pharmaceutical Complex, are working on 3 to 4 projects at the same time. The vaccine types being developed are different too. 2 to 3 of them are the inactivated type. 2 or 3 others are the subunit type. Some other companies are working on mRNAs, and the others are working on recombinant models.
As for what Iran is depending on thus far for the shorter term, officials say Iran will receive around 16 million doses of vaccines through the World Health Organization's COVAX program. It will import more than 25 million doses from abroad, and it will produce 25 million other doses inside the country.
Therefore, a different variety of vaccines that we have heard about in the world are being researched and developed in Iran, and some of them are still in the laboratory stage. Some of them, fortunately, have gone through animal stage, and as we speak, 3 of these vaccines have reached the human trial stage.
But the vaccine is not everything. In the case of COVID-19, prevention is most definitely better than cure. As there is no cure, but only medicine to ease symptoms, and vaccines with an effect lasting only months so far. Does that mean it is not worth the effort to make vaccines? It certainly does not. Mass vaccine production and administration would break the chain of transmission and render the virus controllable. That is why masks and social distancing have been recommended and enforced.
Many in our medical staff aren't willing to take the vaccines because of all the uncertainty around them. We can't force them to take the shots. We can only do that after we develop the vaccine and people trust that it doesn't have any side effects. It's not possible at this point. We haven't yet established that the vaccines are free of complications.
Iran's potential in production is praiseworthy. Authorities boast every medicine which was said to be effective with the coronavirus was produced inside the country within less than 3 months. Test kits and ventilators were also produced, and the vaccine only came after.
We started plasma therapy here at the Baghiyat Allah University of Medical Sciences around late March last year. We have very professional specialists. They knew that when there was an antibody, the patient's plasma and blood serum could help cure the disease. We took it and tested it with caution from those who recovered from COVID-19 and had high levels of antibodies in their blood, which was successful. Then the Americans started doing the same thing by using our published articles.
We are here at a military bus and mobile hospital site. It boasts state-of-the-art medical equipment and facilities. Facilities that you would expect to see in a well-equipped hospital with roots in the ground. But then whatever it is what makes it unique in West Asia. Let's step in together to see for ourselves what it has to offer.
One of the drugs we had trouble procuring, especially during the second wave of the coronavirus outbreak, was remdesivir. The 100 milligram vials of this drug were very rare, so much so that patients had to purchase them at 80 million Iranian rials per vial through black markets. Thankfully, we have no shortage right now. Remdesivir was prescribed for COVID patients who are in critical conditions. The other drug given to cases who are experiencing a less severe form of the disease and are staying at home is favipravir. We have enough supplies of this medicine at our hospitals and aren't experiencing any shortage.
High up in the IRGC Land Forces chain of command, Mr. Akhavan is on the Mobile Hospitals Committee. He summed his pride in the project, which was inaugurated March the 14th with the health minister, in the few minutes he had with us on site.
Establishing field hospitals for COVID-19 patients requires special infrastructure. They need mobile CT scans, oxygen generators, and mobile PCRs. Intensive care units, especially mobile ICUs, require better ventilation with more suitable spaces and many other features. This field hospital here is a specialized unit with 128 beds. One of its characteristics is speed. This entire unit can be moved to any point in the country very fast.
Who can blame the doctors and nurses and pharmacists for savoring a brand new experience in terms of the scale of field hospital work?
I can almost say that in the past we were successful in 40 to 50% of the cases, considering the equipment we had back then. But now, with the new hospital, we have been able to help people 90 to 100% of the time.
The fact is that we used to provide health care to deprived areas in tents. But now, in this perfect filled hospital, we have almost everything. Everything is organized and everywhere is clean and tidy, as you see. The comfort of the staff is really very important, because I believe that if the staff does not get tired, there is no other problem. One of the problems we used to have before in the tents was the lack of order. On the other hand, tents were either very cold or very hot because of the various weather conditions. But now, thank God, all these problems have been sorted out.
Speaking of the difficulty of our work, take me for example. I have two children who are not very old. One is 7 years old and the other is 9. My husband is also in the military and has a job that's like mine. We've been here since the weekend and we may have to stay until the end of the week if no problem comes up, God willing. If needed, we have to stay here longer. This causes problems in our personal lives. Living like this for a mother with two kids is difficult.
Preventative measures prevail, even if at times in a haphazard fashion, given Iran's cultural and economic conditions. Travel to cities coded orange and red have been prohibited. Those are cities with horribly high rates of transmission. The government left its final announcement for New Year travel bans or easing of travel restrictions to 15th March. That's under a week to the 13-day New Year holidays. I asked my interviewees for an evaluation of the sum of efforts by the National Coronavirus Headquarters.
اومدی تقریبا چند ماه الان.
We have imposed nighttime restrictions for several months, but haven't enforced them too seriously. There have been countries that imposed 5 p.m. to 6 a.m. lockdowns all of a sudden, and their death toll reduced to as low as 10 people per day. Social distancing is of paramount importance at this point. No tool is as effective as distancing, even face masks, because in my opinion, masks are signs that we need to maintain our distance.
Iranians traditionally make hundreds of thousands of domestic New Year trips annually. Can you blame them, with 31 provinces to go to, each with a world-class wonder on display? Still, they have been urged not to plan trips to contagious regions, as the country's healthcare system has a limit. The public should maintain last year's lifestyle for another year, the president himself stressed. Iran is set to vaccinate enough people by the end of 2021 to reach herd immunity. The country is working on expanding all corona-related services.
So far, we have deployed 200 mobile hospitals in different parts of the country in various geographical areas. The units provide the services for a week to some 4 million people. A memorandum of understanding is being reviewed between the Ministry of Health and the Ground Forces to bring 10 similar units to different military bases across the country.
Goes without say, international borders have been under check, with the coronavirus mutating and traveling at will. Iran began suspending flights to London in December 2020 over concerns about a surge in coronavirus cases and a new COVID variant in the UK. Also, the country in February closed 5 crossing points with Iraq to prevent the spread of the UK variant of the coronavirus again. Border customs offices, however, remained open to commerce, with traders and business persons from both countries presumably observing health protocols, of course.
Everyone was confused at the beginning of the outbreak, and even some countries like the United States said there was no problem at all. I think the health and treatment conditions of our country is unique, due to the separation of the health ministry and the science ministry, something which exists in almost no other country. Until 1985, we had a minister of science that trained all medical, paramedical, and nursing students. We also had a minister of health. Several hospitals were under the supervision of the Minister of Science to educate students, while some others provided health services. The initiative in the Islamic Republic, which I think was an appropriate one, brought together the Minister of Health and the Minister of Education. In my opinion, the universities that provide health services, too, have been very successful in controlling and preventing COVID-19.
As implied earlier, what has kept the country going with the coronavirus mutating and jumping borders is basic hygiene, masks and social distancing, paired with health workers' tireless efforts and hospitals braving anything thrown at them. Hospitals have had to manage both their own resources and volunteers demanding they be trained to help. Classical hospitals, however, aren't the only ones with something to say for themselves. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's going to be on. And do leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Instead of gritting teeth for another couple of months before a solid majority of adults are vaccinated, governors and mayors are relaxing or ending restrictions on businesses and public gatherings from Massachusetts to Texas, from California to Mississippi, from Michigan to Utah, from South Carolina to Nevada, from Maryland to Washington, and from New York to Arizona, says Derek Z. Jackson author in an article titled From Texas to Mississippi, States Dismantle COVID-19 Safety Protocols at People's Peril. Stay tuned for more. The gusto of reopening already has epidemiologists bracing for a fourth gale of coronavirus. Instead of gritting teeth for another couple of months before a solid majority of adults are vaccinated, governors and mayors are relaxing or ending restrictions on businesses and public gatherings, from Massachusetts to Texas, from California to Mississippi, from Michigan to Utah, from South Carolina to Nevada, from Maryland to Washington, and from New York to Arizona. Instead of legislatures scrambling for a few more weeks of financial relief to keep businesses and families afloat, the United States is witnessing a mass reopening of business offices, restaurants, sport arenas and stadiums, concert halls, movie theaters, amusement parks, gyms, hair salons, barbershops, and spas. Many states are trying to shoehorn teachers back into classrooms, whether or not they are vaccinated. With the U.S. economy down 9.5 million jobs and social life relegated to Zoom screens, many policymakers have completely forgotten the deadly consequences of last spring's abrupt, premature ending of lockdowns. They're ignoring that the nation's 7-day rolling average of new confirmed COVID infections has leveled off well above 50,000 a day, more than 5 times the 10,000 a day Fauci has long advocated as the threshold for considering a major relaxing of restrictions. Leaders are shrugging off the growing dominance of COVID-19 variants and the fact that, as of March 15, New York Times tracking, only 21% of people in the United States had received even one vaccine dose. Only 12% of people are fully vaccinated. Reckless and a national embarrassment. Experts say Texas and Mississippi ignore the reality. The most jaw-dropping examples are Texas and Mississippi, which ended just about every restriction, including mask requirements. Governor Greg Abbott declared Texas to be open 100%. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves said, "We are not going to continue to use the heavy hand of government when it is no longer justified by the reality we see around us." According to the March 15th New York Times coronavirus map, Mississippi's 7-day average of daily new cases has plateaued at levels seen just before its fearsome July and January surges. Texas is on a similar roller coaster. After hitting a record 342 deaths a day on a 7-day rolling average in late January, Texas is back down to 161. But that is still more than 5 times the starting point of last summer's surge, and 3 times the level of average daily fatalities in October that kept the Texas ripe for this winter's deadly wave. Texas and Mississippi also have some of the lowest vaccination rates in the nation as of March 15th, with respectively only 19 and 20% of residents receiving even a first dose. And as of March 15th, Texas and Mississippi were above the 5% COVID-19 positivity rate recommended by the World Health Organization for reopening. Mississippi's March 16 positivity rate of nearly 14% is the 6th highest in the U.S., nearly 3 times the WHO's recommended rate for reopening. All those numbers have Vice Chancellor Luann Woodward of the University of Mississippi Medical Center saying it is not yet time to end mask mandates. Mayors in the biggest cities of both the states, most of whom saw COVID-19 first hit hardest in black or brown communities, were united in their protest of their governors willfully plowing ahead to risk a new wave of infections. In Greenville, Mississippi, which is 82% black, Mayor Eric Simmons said Reeves was being reckless at a crucial moment in the fight. In Jackson, Mississippi, also 82% black, Mayor Chokwe Anthor Lumumba said he will maintain a local mask order. The outrageousness in Texas and Mississippi is the leading edge of a major outbreak of dispensing with social distancing. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey lifted capacity restrictions for most businesses despite the Health System Alliance of Arizona, which represents more than 80 acute hospitals in the state, saying, "Now is not time to relax our mitigation efforts." The rush by U.S. governors and legislatures to get rid of the mask after they have lost the world-leading 530,000 lives actually runs counter to the still high public support for masking and social distancing. An Associated Press NORC poll recently found that 82% of respondents wear a mask when encountering people outside their homes. 77% practiced social distancing, 72% avoided non-essential travel, and 66% avoided other people as much as possible. As for the specific act of lifting mask mandates, 56% of respondents said they were being lifted too quickly in an ABC News Ipsos poll recently. The economic pain has been crushing. The restaurant sector has been seen the closure of 110,000 establishments and has lost 2 million jobs, according to the National Restaurant Association. The 800,000 jobs lost in the arts, entertainment, and recreation industry represents a third of the sector, according to a University of New Hampshire analysis. Many state and local government budgets have run dry, losing another 1.3 million jobs. One way of understanding what is at risk if the nation does not make that push comes from a New York Times analysis last month of data from the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. A full reopening everywhere could result in herd immunity by May at the collateral cost of 320,000 additional deaths. And that is before factoring in the unknown effect of variants, which could double American current toll past the 1 million mark. Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut, California, and Pennsylvania as examples are far from boasting that they are 100% open but are still alarming many public health experts by relaxing all kinds of capacity restrictions for social gatherings, movie theaters, theme parks, and sports and entertainment venues. In Massachusetts, William Hank of Harvard University School of Public Health told WGBH Radio that Governor Charlie Baker's relaxing of restrictions is going to provide more contacts, which means that those cases are going to go up again. Once we start giving the virus more opportunities to transmit, it's going to take them, he said. In New York City and New York State, controversy is bubbling over with both Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo accused of sidelining science and chasing out public health officials as they crafted a more political and economic response to the pandemic. Kumo, fighting for his political life with sexual harassment accusations, is also accused of undercounting COVID-19 nursing home deaths. Most state actions also seem to run counter to CDC guidance for fully vaccinated people. While fully vaccinated people are now free to socialize indoors with other fully vaccinated people with no masks, the CDC still recommends against gathering with unvaccinated people from more than one household, avoiding medium or large-sized gatherings, and delaying domestic and international travel. Governors are dangerously close to running a red.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. 1 year has passed since 26-year-old Breonna Taylor was killed in her own home by Louisville, Kentucky police in a no-knock raid. She was an emergency medical technician who had no police record. On the anniversary of her brutal slaying, protesters have taken to the streets in several U.S. cities calling for justice. So far, none of the officers involved in her killing have been charged with the crime. Will this be just another dead black person where people call for justice but are unlikely to get it? I'd like to turn to Washington, D.C., and talk to Colin Campbell. Colin, good to have you with us. Well, tell us about what has taken place during this 1 year and also, of course, on the anniversary.
That's right. And we look at how much progress has been made since Breonna Taylor's death. And as we can tell, not much has been done. These people who are protesting are outraged over the constant ignorance and neglect of trying to find justice for Breonna Taylor, as there have not been any substantive arrests made in her death. We do know that there have been some money in a wrongful death lawsuit and things like that, but as far as really punitively punishing the people who are responsible for her death, the state has come very far short. Not to mention, we found out soon after the verdict came out that the Attorney General really did not provide the right amount of evidence or withheld certain pieces of evidence from being submitted that would render a verdict where Breonna Taylor would not get ultimate justice for being killed while being innocently in her home. And I think that's why you're seeing so many people who are frustrated and just angry and outraged at all of this, is because it could happen to any one of them. It could happen to any one of us, where you could be in your home doing something that you do normally every day, grabbing a pot of coffee, talking on the phone with a friend or a loved one, watching television, and you could be shot dead, and the person responsible for that could still walk around freely without any type of compassion or any type of punitive measure being served or any type of justice being rendered to the victim. And again, we are seeing these protests in Kentucky. We are seeing them in other parts of the United States as they look at other grievances that have come at the hands of police.
Thanks so much for that update, Colin Campbell. Staying in D.C., I'd like to welcome Matthew Fogg, former Chief Deputy, U.S. Marshals Service. Matthew, thanks so much for being with us. Why does this just seem to repeat and repeat itself again? In your perspective, why haven't we seen any officer charged so far in the death of Breonna?
Well, thank you for having me on. I think one of the problems is the historical issues we have in this country with law enforcement, and especially people of color. We know that it's been disproportionately applied. We know that across the criminal justice system all the way. And the problem is in law enforcement, having been in it for 30 years, officers can make mistakes. I got that. I understand that. But when you see it happening over and over again for the same happening, when it's a race issue, it becomes a race issue, which racism is systemic in America now, and the president, everybody has admitted to it. The problem is, how do you hold people accountable? And you've got systems and institutions in place. These officers got a no-knock warrant. They went and knocked on, went to Breonna Taylor's location and ended up mistakenly, whatever you want to call it. But the bottom line is she wound up dying in that process, and nobody was ever held accountable. And what we're seeing over and over again, and I saw it in my own self in law enforcement, it's very difficult to have the whole white officers actually be accountable for killing black citizens. And there were always some, yeah, money is paid out, but there's no accountability. So, and as long as the system remains in its place, you will continue to have these type of incidents. And until the government and everybody comes together and says, listen, this is a race matter. We got to deal with it as a race matter. And people have to be held accountable if they do the wrong things. And I'll feel when you do the wrong thing, somebody can get killed. So the bottom line is you got to start holding people accountable. And it seems like this system still is not ready to really hold culprits accountable for the things that when we do things wrong in law enforcement. Again, it's a race issue. It's going down party lines, race issues. When it seems to be an issue against black Americans, black and brown Americans.
Okay, stay with me, Matthew. Let me welcome my next guest, Yane Ndengo, a writer, singer, and activist out of Philadelphia. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, you heard, hopefully, what Matthew was saying, that it is very difficult to see white officers being charged in the killing of black Americans. We know that the opposite. Listening to interviewers before of black police officers who are very careful, especially if before they want to fire at a white individual. But the other side of the coin is not the same. What is it going to take to change that status quo?
Well, I think we have to examine this from the core and from the root of where this comes from. And racism is definitely a key component, but racism is actually a tool of imperialism, of capitalism, of patriarchy, and those are the things that are really driving this. And the reason that the status quo is not being changed is because it supports the elite in the U.S. and those people who are in the ruling class who actually benefit from the discrepancies in the ways that the legal system is applied depending on the parties that are involved. And so while police officers may make mistakes, the police as a larger overarching organization and agency, it's spoken as if it is here for to serve and protect all members of the community, but their really primary purpose is to protect the property owners, the people who have the most wealth. And so all of the issues of the dynamics around race actually support the stopping people from fighting against the class and capitalist issues that are in place in the U.S. because people will allow things to happen that that are inappropriate or that are wrong because it is because of their racism. And they will support things that are happening that are inappropriate because of their racism. And even if the system that is in place is not one that supports the best interest of most people in the country, and most working class people don't benefit from the current system that's in place. So we need to look deeper than even just the race concern. Race is significant, but we have to recognize it as a tool of the larger oppressive system that is used to keep working class and poor people disempowered and prevent them from working together.
Well, staying with what you just talked about as far as it being a class issue and it being a tool of imperialism. With that being the case, then why don't we see, for example, there obviously poor white individuals who are struggling, but in general, we see this continuously targeting black people, and actually sometimes it could be black people who are wealthy or middle class. So tell me, how does that fit into what you're saying?
Well, because as I said, racism, I'm not suggesting that racism does not exist. Racism is embedded in our society in the United States. However, racism is intentionally embedded because it is a tool that is of the capitalist class. And so what ends up happening is that because there are individuals or groups of individuals, they serve almost as buffers against the ruling class. And so that is what the larger white community serves. That's how the larger white community serves. Its role is to actually keep the issues and the concerns of other communities. So it's kind of like a divide and conquer tactic. So you have like working class white people's their material interests are much more aligned with those of working class black people and working class brown people, but they fight against those individuals because of their association with whiteness, even though they don't actually gain a lot of the benefits of whiteness aside from certain much more superficial privileges. I mean, and substantial privileges like not having to be murdered by police, but by having the ability to feel that you can count on police and trust police and feel safe with police, it helps you to diminish looking at the reality that other communities are experiencing and work in collaboration with them to address the oppressive conditions that all working class and poor people face.
Okay, well, Matthew, in 2020, after George Floyd's murder, people across the U.S. took to the streets and saying Black Lives Matter and calling for accountability. What happened with that movement? Has anything changed?
I won't say necessarily that it's changed, because what I'm hearing is still Black Lives Matter. They're still continuing to gear up the protest and to try to do more things that change laws, regulations. We were just in Annapolis, Maryland, trying to get the policeman's law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights changed. But one of the things I noticed, just like I'm the class agent, we've got a class discrimination lawsuit against the U.S. Marshals Service. All of the black agents, most of them in the Marshals Service, we're all in part of a class. You got a lot of class actions popping up all over the country in these law enforcement departments, which says internally we as the law enforcement officers recognize the racial disparities and the discrimination that's taking place within our departments. We don't want to do it anymore. We don't want to follow those patterns where you can see this, it's a pattern of discrimination and racial disparity. But when we speak out, of course, then the institution in turn turns on us. So we are hoping now that more and more officers internally will speak out and will stop saying, no, we're not going to be serving and doing these no-knock warrants and things like this just in black communities. I've always said, if we did this stuff all over the country in the white communities where we serve drug warrants and everything else, this stuff would have stopped a long time ago. So what we have to understand is that we have to take a role, and that's where the law enforcement officers, I think, internally are beginning to step up to the plate, like I said, when we talk about these various law enforcement departments. So it is what the caller said. It is a problem that's deeply embedded that comes from a historical position in America on policing. But we can take control of it, those as black officers. When we start speaking out and standing up and saying, along with the community, we join in with the community, we say, we're not putting up with this anymore.
Well Matthew, staying with what you've just said, as far as black officers can bring about a change. However, I want to look at that, because if they go against the status quo, do you not think that they will be reprimanded and many times losing their jobs? I mean, we can widen this out, actually, and even look at, for example, the U.S. military, and many minorities play a big role in the U.S. military. And, of course, as Malcolm X said, and of course, Muhammad Ali, just sending poor people to fight other black and brown and poor people around the world. So is it realistic that a change can come from within?
I think it can. I mean, let me put it this way. I've been fighting the Marshals Service for, 30 years or so throughout my whole career. I won a major lawsuit against the Justice Department. There were some changes that was made. But again, and people are talking about it, but the dialogue has to be raised. And that's where, when Black Lives Matter and with the pandemic and we had Donald Trump as president, we had things that lined up that said, this is the time. So I really think right now we're in an era. We've got a new president. We've got somebody that's with a new attorney general, somebody that's speaking this language and actually admitting that systemic racism exists and law enforcement exists in all aspects of our structural system, and we have to change it. Once you get people admitting it, And then you've got people coming forward, afraid, not afraid they're going to lose a job, like I lost my job. I went through everything that you could imagine when I first stood up. And now we've got critical mass where people are coming out, and law enforcement, the professionals are coming out admitting it and testifying and saying, yes, I've observed this type of racism. I see it happening. I can tell you this person, that person is carrying it out. Now you start to see the other side where people had these racist views start to back up a little bit. We got a lot of police officers, law enforcement people that are part of these right-wing groups, the sympathizers that had these jobs and were happy. And now they're feeling a little antsy because they realize now that people are watching them and everybody's on notice. So I think this is a time for change, and I think that that can happen.
Well, Yanni, how can the United States make the necessary changes to ensure equality when the capitalist system itself has been established via genocide and slavery? And to really bring about a change would mean basically dismantling the system itself. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, that's really the truth, and that's one of the reasons why the system fights against change as much as it does, and the agents of the system fight against that change. I am an organizer of Black Lives Matter Philly, along with the Black Lives for Peace, the Black Philly Radical Collective, and Begin to Freedom. And one of the things that we say is there are no good cops in a racist system. And a lot of times people want to like try to boil down to individuals, but the individuals can't change the system. You move one person out with their good intentions. You have one person with their good intentions. You replace them with anybody else. You know, the system is the same. So even you replace a person with bad intentions with someone with good intentions, the system is the same. And so unless we dismantle the system, even when it comes to the extraction from other countries, the extraction from Africa, the entire African continent, if the U.S. and the Western forces were to stop those extractions, their entire economies would fall. And so there has to be a willingness amongst the people to imagine something completely new and different for all working class people. But the current system has poverty, it has violence, it has homelessness, it has those things embedded in them, because it's the only way that you can continue to take the resources and give and put them in the hands of a very few people and keep them there. And so once we begin to shift and shift from a completely systemic perspective and have people understanding that reality, which is the reason why I express the fact that this imperialism and capitalism are key and that racism is a tool to them. That's my perspective, that racism is a tool of these things and that it helps to keep the people divided. Once people overcome those things and begin to recognize that there is an enemy, that the enemy is actually those who are hoarding all of the resources from the people, and that these different militarized aspects of, or these militarized arms are actually human beings that are being used in order to diminish and to take the lives of and oppress the majority of people, not just in the United States, not even just Black people, but around the world, we're not going to be able to see a difference. But we do have to still recognize that there is a substantial burden that is formed by the Black and Native people in the United States around this system. So even though there are people who are working class white people and poor white people that are actually suffering as well, because poverty, it goes across the board, there is an added burden that is borne by the people who are coming, who are of African descent, and the people who are native to the land, because they are needed to be the redirected as the enemies of the people, so that the people who do have the same common interests are fighting against each other and not challenging our true enemy in the ruling class.
Well, Matthew, now Black people have been killed by figures of authorities for hundreds of years, and now in 2021, it's still happening. Now, there are more and more Black activists who are looking at separatism as a way, believing that they will only get equity by establishing their own nation. Your take on that side of things?
Well, I think it's an expression, it cats out the bag. I don't know if you can really try to set up a separate nation at this point, but you can set up a separate system that's determined that it will fight against racism and the issues that the fallout from it. Again, we're talking about Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and Eric Garner. We can go on and on and on. And how is this current climate and world, and what I've seen, like I said, now what I'm seeing is If these officers are willing to come forward in law enforcement in that field, that's what we drove us to this point, willing to come forward and begin to identify the bigot cops. You know, I'm writing a book, Bigots with Badges, and identify how we can fight the racism from within, I think we can start to see change. Now, of course, we know that our Congress and the great lawmakers in this country still, there's a racial divide, even when we look at the makeup of our Congress and everything else. And we start to address these issues seriously. Black Lives Matter, marching, coming out forward. Because you've got to have protests. You've got to have people come forward and to put this thing on the front burner. And I just believe from that perspective, we will start to see changes, even with the marijuana laws, the drug laws, the things that we as cops was used, all types of methods to just throw people in jail because we wanted to get our numbers up. A lot of that is going to start to change, and I'm seeing it now beginning to slowly but surely happen. So I think this is the time, and I thank God for your caller who is with Black Lives Matter, because I've always supported that particular movement, knowing that the purpose of it was to bring attention to all of this stuff. And that's the only way you're going to deal with it. Things have to be put on the front burner. We got to deal with it, and we got to let America know, us as employees, and when they try to utilize us to go against and to carry out these racist, these one-sided viewpoints, we say, no, we're not doing this anymore. We're going to stand up against it. And I think that's the viewpoint that we got to get across to America.
Well, Yanni, how do you think that the perspective that you were talking about, that basically you talked about, of course, the racial aspect of it, but in a capitalist system, it's more the haves and the have-nots, the 1% versus the 99%. So taking that in perspective, then, for example, there's a Secretary of Defense who's black, there's a Vice President who's black, but if they're supporting that same imperialist system, then color really doesn't matter. So with that being said, Yanni, do you think that more and more people are understanding the importance of the class differences, the importance of this basic war that's been declared against 99% by the 1%? And how key is that in your perspective for people to understand?
I think that there is an understanding. However, the reality of racism, the history of racism, and the differences in what people have experienced creates different interests and different levels of attachment to the current system, because people are enabled to become empowered. So you do have black people who are in positions of power, they still act as agents of white supremacy, right? And so that doesn't get transformed. You do have changes that happen, but the changes are always done in a way that still helps to maintain the status quo. A perfect example is looking at the difference between, like, we had enslavement and now we have mass incarceration. Mass incarceration is just a new way to enslave people, and a lot of the labor that you know, a lot of people labor in these prisons. They're basically free labor. They can be loaned out. And so what we have to do is we have to, as a people, we have to do the work internally to overcome the realities that have been programmed into us so that we can begin to stop functioning as agents of this oppressive system. And then we have to also recognize that we have to create completely new systems. We cannot just try to transform what's in place. We have to dismantle it and build something that cares.